Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Primetime Wednesday night on Authors on the Air. I'm Pam Stack, your host. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight's a very special night because we're celebrating and honoring International Women's Day, a day without women, and we're rocking red. So I have two very special people with me right now, best-selling author Wendy Tyson and author and publicist Lisa Daly. Lisa is going to be my co-host. I can't wait to introduce you to both of these fabulous women. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Much for joining me tonight. I want to first introduce you to my co-host, Lisa Daly. Lisa is an author. She is having her new book published with St. Martin's Press. She also is a publicist with the powerhouse publishing house of Ocean View Publishing, which incidentally is right up the highway from me in Southwest Florida. I'm proud to welcome to the show Lisa Daly. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to Authors on the Air.
Hi, Kim.
I'm so glad. This is so cool that you agreed to co-host. Thank you.
I'm excited that you asked me to.
We have. Are you rocking your red today and you're drinking your red wine?
I am.
Okay, so you're fading
in
and out. Remember we talked about that in soundcheck? You're fading in and out. So I'm going to let you hang up and call me back in on the number I gave you and see if we can't stabilize the call, because I don't want you fading in and out, okay?
We'll do that right now.
Okay, call me right back in. In the meantime, I'm going to introduce Wendy, so I'll pick you right back up as soon as you call in. Now, my guest tonight is Wendy Tyson. Now, Wendy, first of all, now I'm not even going to tell you what she writes. This is what she writes in her bio. I love this. She says, "I love determined, gutsy women, women who aren't afraid to go after what they want, women who are not afraid to speak up, to laugh, to fight for the underdog, to fall in love. Women who aren't afraid to live every day." She said, "I aspire to be that kind of a woman. In the meantime, I write about them." Well, let me tell you something. You so are that woman, Wendy Tyson. Welcome to Authors on the Air.
Oh, thank you, Pam. I am so excited to be here, very honored. And I love your show, so thanks for having me on
Thank
tonight.
You. And I love your books. And Lisa is back with us. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. It's such a powerful statement.
Isn't it? And particularly today, when we're talking about women and women writers and how women just inspire me every single day of my life. You know, I don't know how it was when you were growing up, but my mom kind of was, she was super mom. I don't know how she did it. She was the foundation for every good thing in my life and every good thing in our family.
Aww.
So, you know, I was really lucky and I miss her every single day. I still want to pick up the phone and say, "Mom, you won't believe this. I'm talking to Wendy Tyson today." You know, those are the moments I have, you know.
Yeah.
You won't believe who I'm talking to. But so I love the fact that you say this in your bio, Wendy. Who are your hero women, your sheroes, I should say?
You know, there's so many, but I would say I look to my own family. Similar to you, I grew up in an extended family of incredibly strong women. My great-grandmother,
wow,
with whom I was very close, she came over from Italy when she was 11. And
wow.
That was back like 1911. She came over, was married off at 16 to a man that she didn't know. And she didn't speak the language. She didn't really fit in from a cultural standpoint, and yet she taught herself business. She ended up being a house flipper. She flipped houses before it was cool.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and she would buy it, and she had six kids. She would fix up the house and then resell her profit and move on to the next property. And that's, I mean, she was married, but that was her contribution. And her husband died young, and she just was an incredibly resilient and resourceful woman. And, you know, I saw that with all of the women in my life, my mother, my grandmother. So I think, you know, for me, that was a mindset from a very early age.
Oh, God, what a spectacular thing. I didn't know my grandparents, so I'm jelly for sure, you know, that you had that experience. So, which probably goes to why I just love older people so much, you know, although I'm getting to be an older people too. But
it's, I know, it's so funny.
That's I'm not you, Pam. You never age. You never age.
I swear to God, Lisa, I am. More, at the end of a long day, I really am.
You go to sleep, you renew overnight, all better in the morning.
Right. There you go. There you go. It's a rebirth every day. Who are your women influences, Lisa?
Oh, my gosh. When I'm sitting here listening to Wendy talk about the women in her family, I'm thinking about how similar they are to the women in my family, the women in your family. My mother is an incredible influence. My grandmother, which is really funny, this is actually the reason I became a writer, because – you know, aside from the fact that I think it's just who I was, my grandmother always wanted a writer in the family, and she used to always really encourage my mom and her sister, my aunt, to write. And so I grew up from the time I was, you know, really young, you know, writing poems and songs and little stories. But I would hear this over and over again, oh, Grandma Vernie always wanted a writer in the family. And so when I became an author, it was such a source of pride for me. And she passed away when I was about 8. She died of cancer. But it's still, even now, you know, such a point of pride. And I'm really fortunate. My mother was really, you know, is a really strong woman. My aunt, her sister, you know, ran for mayor back in the 70s of her little town.
Oh,
and,
God.
You know, burned her bra and marched and all that. That sort of activism and strength has been just sort of part of, you know, of the legacy of my family for as long as I can remember, and I hope to pass it on to my daughter.
Wow, that's really great. That's awesome. Well, let's talk about writing, because, you know, that's what the show's about, and you two are both writers. So, I want to talk very much about your books, first of all, Wendy, because I just love, first of all, how your cover art drew me in like nobody's business. I mean, majorly, you drew me in. Cover art, it's really amazing. And I'm talking about, I think they're the two most recent books, but you write so much that it's hard for me to know, but A Muddied Murder and Bitter Harvest. I love those covers. They remind me of Seed Bag.
Seed packet,
seed,
right?
Yes, the old fashioned seed packet. Right?
Is that what it's supposed to be?
And I have to credit that my publisher. My publisher, they designed that cover. They came up with that concept. And I remember the day that they sent the mock-up to my agent and to me. And I was, honestly, I had a tear in my eye. I was like, it was so perfect for the series. They just captured it beautifully.
It really is. And you can really see how it's going to play out over the life of the series. I mean, you could just go on with this forever. I mean, it's so interesting visually, and so, you know, it seems so perfect for the work. And it's hard a lot of times for authors, you know, you don't have much control over the cover that you get. So I'm sure you said you had a tear in your eye when you saw these. Do you have covers that you didn't care for as much?
No, not so much, but I think my other series, the Allison Campbell series, with the same publisher, the covers are a little bit more straightforward.
Yes, they are.
And this series, is just very, it's a topic I feel passionate about. It's a series I felt passionate about, and I knew the publisher was excited about it, and I just felt like they captured that so well. We had had some conversations. They had asked for some input. They're good about that, and, you know, but this was their design.
It really differentiates the two series. So let's just explain. A Muddied Murder and A Bitter Harvest are mysteries, and they are called the Greenhouse Mysteries, just by the way, so that you know. And the first book, A Muddied Murder, has a picture of tomato on the front, and the second book has a picture of pumpkin on the cover. And everybody is raving about this. You get so many amazingly great reviews, and I'm really happy for you because you so deserve it. Now, I have not read the new book, but snaps to you. You just released the second book, A Bitter Harvest, yesterday, didn't you?
I did, yes.
So how about you give us the background story on the Greenhouse Mysteries, and then we'll talk about A Muddied Murder first, and then we'll talk about Bitter Harvest. Will you share, please?
Sure. Pam, when you say the background, do you want how the idea came to be, or just a quick overview of the concept?
Yes. I want that, too. I want everything that you want to tell us.
So I'll say that this series is a little bit more of a cozy series. The Allison series is a little edgier. I have a standalone novel out there called The Seduction of Miriam Cross, which is edgier still, but is no longer in print. And what I set out to do with the Greenhouse series was, you know, I still wanted the suspense and the intricate plot, but with kind of a softer, I guess, approach. I had just finished, I think it was the second or third Allison book, and I was at a book signing in North Carolina, this tiny little adorable rural town in North Carolina, and nobody came to my book signing, not one person.
Oh, that's a rough.
But, yeah, it was, except that, Lemonade, the woman who owned the bookstore was extremely friendly, we got to know her, and then I also saw how the townspeople were. So it was toward the end of the day, and their kids would wander into the bookstore, and she'd give them books and the cookies that we had out for the signing, and they would come and ask me questions. And then, you know, one of the shopkeepers would pop their head in and say, hey, can you watch so-and-so for 15 minutes? You know, I have to run to the school. And this was, like, for an hour and a half what I witnessed.
Wow.
It was very cool, and we wandered down the road to a beer store. It was like a gourmet beer store, and more of that type of interaction. And I was leaving this kind of failed book signing, I realized that that's why people read cozy mysteries, that comfort of coming home. And
absolutely.
It was, you know, soon after, you know, one of the tragedies that had occurred, and I thought, do that. Combine your passion for organic gardening and regenerative farming with this cozy world, and that's where the idea came from. So,
and you witnessed it too, and so that you walked in the footsteps of your characters, which is really cool.
I did, because I live in the suburbs of Philadelphia. Now, that's not to say that Philly doesn't have its neighborhoods, and that there's not a sense of community in my suburb. But
sure.
I think for that, you know, isolated small town feel, it just was a reminder of that sense of community. Definitely.
So the book that released yesterday, A Bitter Harvest, received a star review from Publishers Weekly. And those of us who know about Publishers Weekly know that it is so difficult to get that. I mean, they'll do a review, but to give it a starred review is really extra special. So
that's
this
a
is,
huge
I'm going to read
deal.
To you. It is a huge deal. So I'm going to read to you what the reviewer said. Tyson's first-rate second Greenhouse Mystery stars big city lawyer turned small-town organic farmer Megan Sawyer, a kind, intelligent, and spirited woman with great integrity. In short, she's the sort of person cozy readers warm to and root for. Tyson populates the cast with a smug but attractive PR consultant, a temperamental but gifted chef, a shrewd and sexy Scottish vet, and assorted townspeople whose motives are complex and believable. It's a pleasure to spend time in their company. What a really great review that is.
It was a nice review.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank
you. It's a really nice review. So I can't wait to read it. And you're going to have your publicist send me a book.
I will send you a copy myself, Pam.
You will?
You almost
get
the same sense from the Publisher's Weekly review that the reviewer sort of had the same type of experience that you had in that bookstore, you know, watching these neighbors sort of come in and out and interact with each other, that you sort of gave them that experience.
Yeah, and so much of the cozy world, and really it's traditional mystery, right? When you, generally traditional mystery, but set in a series, is about world building. And so, you know,
yes,
when you set out to create that world, yeah, absolutely. So I felt like that came through in the review.
Do you have a series going now that you're going to stick with for a little while? Because it seems to me, while your town may be small, you've left enough room for a lot of different things to happen, to have a lot of different mysteries. And you have enough characters, starting with a muddied murder, to make it very, very interesting. So,
yeah,
will this become kind of a long, cozy series, do you think?
That's the intent. I'm currently contracted for 6. So,
oh, wow.
At least 6. Yeah, we have the third coming out later on this year.
Oh, my God.
That's fantastic.
It's so incredible.
It's really spectacular.
You know, and good on Henry Press for getting it, giving you that, because your reviews have been great from readers too. I mean, you know, they're almost across the board 5 stars for both books, so that's wonderful. So, speaking of, how important are reader reviews to you, and are you obsessed with reading reviews? Be honest.
Oh my, that's such a great question. Did you say yes, Lisa? yeah.
I will confess, we all read those reviews.
Do you really?
Well, sure. I mean, especially in the beginning, you really want to know how the book is landing, because before the book comes out, the people who have read it are professional reviewers and your beta reading group and your family and friends. And so generally they tend to be fairly supportive. The reviewers are going to, they all have different opinions, and you're going to, get it sort of a different perspective than the reader's perspective. So definitely in the beginning, you're looking at those reviews to see, you know, or do they – I always like to look at the Kindle versions, because then you can see, like, what people what they highlighted. And so I always want to know, like, did the joke land or did it not land? Or, that, you know, are they touched by the same things that I am? So I don't know, is it just me? Do you do that too, Wendy?
You know, I agree that in the beginning you look at them. I remember my very first Malice domestic conference, Harlan Coben was there, and he said, don't look at your reviews. I don't look at my reviews. I think it was Harlan.
Right. Coben saying that after how long and how many books, right?
Right.
That's exactly right. And I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, there's no way that I cannot look at my reviews. And so for that first book, Killer Image, I was absolutely obsessed. But, you know, it reminded me of my first foray into being in a writer's group, right? That first time in a writer's group, anything anybody said, I felt like it was the weight of the world. So if they loved it, I was high on that. If they didn't like it, oh, my gosh, I was the worst writer in the whole world. And I had a review, I had a reader fan write to me after a particularly good review, and she said, enjoy it, but not too much, and just like, you know, take in the bad ones, but not too much. And it was something like that. It was much more eloquent. But she was right, and that's what I've learned over time. So
you have to take it with a grain of salt.
You do, and you learn to trust the voices that make sense, right? If you're hearing the same thing over and over again,
absolutely.
Then it's time to step back and re-examine that.
Okay, so I'm looking at the reviews on both of these books in this series, and you don't have any one-star reviews. So I'm going to tell you, when you get your one-star cherry popped, I don't want you to be upset, because there will be a troll who comes along and says, oh, you know, what were you thinking? Are you delirious? How could you write this book? But don't believe it for a second, and don't let it bring you down, because it's going to happen, you know that, and I just always want to congratulate authors after they get their first one-star review. You know, okay, you've been traumatized, you've got PTSD for a whole week
now,
and now, you can do this. You've gotten through the worst, you've hit rock bottom, let's climb our way out of the pit now. But I want to tell everyone
Not on this series.
Uh-huh.
My first,
I'm looking.
I did get one.
Yeah,
I had several.
You got one.
Somebody, and I think they said it was terrible or horrid or atrocious or something like that.
But you know what the interesting thing is? You don't have, for the other books, you don't have any one-star reviews. It's just for that first one. And, you know, I think a lot of that is jealousy, too, because you never know who's writing those. I mean, I used to, when I'd follow my friends, and, you know, I have way too many to do and too many shows to produce, but I would go and look up who the reviewer was, and, you know, you'd have someone, like, who's reviewing tires and, you know, a cover for their Kindle and makeup and stuff like that, and I'm thinking, you know, that doesn't count. You know, if you have someone who's consistently reviewing books in your genre and the reviews are mixed, they neither like everything nor do they hate everything, I think that's fair, you know. Then it just wasn't their cup of tea. I would prefer people don't put bad reviews on. I never review. If it's below 4 or 5 stars, I never put up a review. I never want to hurt anyone's feelings. You know, I learned my lesson early on. But for those of you who are listening, A Muddied Murder is on sale right now on Kindle for 99 cents. That is a steal. That's a bestseller in Amazon. Go and get that book right this second. It's in the Zon for 99 cents.
I am getting it right this second, Pam.
I'm telling you, this is what all the hoopla is about. So, absolutely. I want to kick a little bit, and I want to talk to you about your writing process.
Are you a plotter or a pantser?
Yeah, we're going to find that out. You have two completely different kind of books. Alison Campbell Mysteries is really more of thriller than it is. It's not cozy, and And now you're writing cozy. First of all, was it difficult for you to change your mindset on how you were writing? Structure, you know, of writing the book.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, and honestly, oddly, not one I've really thought about. Yes and no. So I would say no in the sense that, first of all, I'm a pantser. I'm not a plotter. And I tend to visualize the story as it's going forward. And so I feel almost like a scribe, just visualizing, visualizing and then writing what's in my head. I do every once in a while have to remind myself when I'm writing the Greenhouse series to keep it a little, the pace a little, I don't want to say slow, but, you know, that to keep that that mindset. But no,
the feel
of it. They both feel so different. The characters feel so different. The settings feel so different that, you know, I'll do a check-in with myself every once in a while, but it's been all right. I also write, I'm working on a standalone thriller, which is not a little edgier than either of those, and I'm having a lot of fun with that. So I answered for a recent interview. I had a similar question. I said, you know, I just love crime fiction. I like it all, from cozy to, you know, big sprawling international thrillers and pretty much everything in between. So
I like crime fiction. I'm there with you. Do you think you'd ever have an interest in writing romantic suspense?
She's
laughing. She's laughing.
I know that's your forte, Lisa. No, and I'll tell you, when I was writing my first the Killer Image series and the Seduction of Mirror and Cross, my agent called me at work one day and said, "Wendy, romance. Can you add some romance?" And I, at the time, I said, "Fran, I've been married for 20 years.
Not happening.
I don't think I would know romance."
Oh.
And I'm kidding, but it's not something that that I like
doesn't
to
do
read
it for
into
you,
the
huh?
mystery.
It's funny too how many women writers will really actively resist romance. I mean, when I first started writing fiction, I was really adamant about the fact that it was like, this is a comedy, there's a romantic element, but it's not a romance. And with the last book that I wrote, the goal of a romance, you know, thing that makes it different from other types of books is that the heroine's goal is,
D-H-E-A.
You know, is the the relationship, the guy by the end of the book. And I have fought against that, you know, and especially because my nonfiction work, I talk about dating and love and relationships and sex. And so I'd felt for a long time like they were, you know, my agent, my publisher tried to sort of box me into that romance thing, and I really did not feel like a romance writer. But then what I realized was that this last book that I wrote, the one that's coming out in June, is, in the most classical sense, a romance. It's about a woman who marries a guy, you know, her childhood sweetheart. Turns out he's gay, so she's a 30-year-old woman who has never been on a date, and she wants to she wants to be a grown up, and that's part of, you know, relationships are part of the grown up experience. And so what I really thought it's not a romance, but there is something to that, and it's interesting because I don't know, you know, I work with a lot of male writers.
Yes,
and
you do.
And they are not pressured. Like, if they have romance in the books, that's great, people love it. But they're not pressured, I think, in the same way that female authors are to include that that romantic element.
Well, you know, it's
interesting.
You're absolutely right about that. I will tell you that there are very few male writers that
mm-hmm.
I've interviewed and read. And you guys know I read like 400 books a year. I mean, Lisa, you know how many books I read.
I do.
Because I'm always bugging you for books. But
yeah.
And I just got some, by the way. Thank you. Matt Buckman, M.L. Buckman, writes some of the best military romance I've ever read in my life. And, I mean, there's sex in it, but it's not sexy. It's not that, you know, it's not erotica or anything like that. It's really sexy romance, and it's really suspenseful because it's military romance. And I'll tell you who else writes really unbelievable romantic scenes, but it's not romance, is James W. Hall, who is my all-time favorite writer of all time. And your pal, Joe Clifford, knows Jim Hall because he was also a professor at FIU where he went to school in the creative writing program.
Right.
So are you familiar with him, Wendy, James W. Hall?
You know,
he writes The Thorn. Okay.
Down.
Oh, my God, you know, his work is so exceptional. His main character's name is Thorne, and because Jim Hall is, he loves the Keys, so he's in Florida half the time and North Carolina half the time. And so this is an off-the-grid kind of a character. And when he writes a love scene, he doesn't say body parts or anything else. He's writing it strictly from a man's point of view. And the passion and the romance in this scene, it is amazing. And it's because he used to be a poet. And I'm convinced that that's why the romance is so beautiful. And it's just a scene. You know, one of his books he opens up after the characters have just made love. I mean, they... He, you know, walks it through from the man's point of view. doesn't name any body parts or anything, but it's just spectacular stuff. So, but you're right. For the most part, I don't. Men tell me they struggle writing love scenes. I don't know if that's true. And a lot of women do too, but it doesn't come to them as easily. I don't know.
I think
it's kind of odd.
I think that's true. And it's interesting because, for me, I always work with so many male mystery writers, and the primary readers of mysteries are women. And
Right. Yeah.
And so it's fascinating to me that, and the thing is that the guys who do, try and create some of that romance or that romantic tension in the books, if they make the attempt and they do a decent job at it, they do really get rewarded for that. Right, the readers really do appreciate it. But it's also, I feel like if Wendy doesn't want to include romance, she shouldn't have to. There are certainly tons of male writers who just don't even go there.
And right. I include romance in the mysteries. I couldn't necessarily see myself writing romance as a genre. But I think you're right. I think it takes, it's a balance, and it takes a certain touch to do it and to do it well. I have an ongoing romantic theme in the Greenhouse series with the veterinarian, and it kind of grew organically out of the story, and so I think it works. But it's funny. I'll tell you, the number one thing I get from readers is about that romantic relationship. Where is it headed? Would I please not throw in unnecessary obstacles?
Were they going to hurt me, get to the point?
Passionately about that.
Because it's a cozy mystery and it's a relationship. It's not sexy romance. That's the difference. And so, I think that readers become grounded in those series characters, and they want to see a smooth road for a while. Yes, they can have bumps and even characters sometimes die off. I understand that. And I'm brave as the writer who will do that, take a main character and bump them off. So, it's a different kind of thing than when you're writing the thriller, because everybody's life is on the line then. Matter how great the relationship is, everybody's. Yeah. I mean, I've been stunned at some characters that have been killed off. So, I want to talk to you a little bit more, Wendy, about since we're discussing kind of women writers and International Women's Day and all. Who are some of the women writers that you're fond of?
Oh gosh, so many across the board. I'm an eclectic reader. I probably read crime fiction the most. Nancy Drew was a big draw for me when I was young. Judy Blume was actually a big draw for me when I was young. Remember the Judy Blume novels? But I would say more recently, anything from, Elizabeth George, I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of Tess Gerritsen. Those are, familiar.
She
but
does
I
it
also
all.
Enjoy Matt.
That woman does it
she
all.
Does.
Tess Gerritsen, it's just amazing. She's a remarkable human being. There's not one thing she's not great at. So Alison Brennan was on last night. She's one of my favorite writers. And and then on Monday I had Deborah Webb on, who's also one of my favorite writers, who by the way, has done, romantic suspense and romantic thrillers, along with having some strong female characters. I love all of her books, too. Of course, she's written over 100, so, no slouch there. I know, she just constantly is putting out product that's so good. Some of her best work is just coming out, too. Are you one of those people, Wendy, who when you're in a crowd or in a restaurant or in a store, you're observing people and thinking, I can make a story out of that. Wonder what they're talking about. Does your brain work like that? Because I've been told that writers are the biggest snoops. Are you?
You know, I don't know if I'm so much a – my background is psychology, and I definitely am intrigued by people, why they do things, the choices that they make. And so I'm always observing. I would agree. I don't necessarily listen, but I guess sometimes I do. And, you know, you never take people and put them whole cloth in your novels, but definitely a look that passes between two people, or a snippet of an overheard conversation, or even just the way someone is sitting on a subway can trigger a story or a character. Absolutely.
When you start to write or you're getting ready to write a book, do you start off with the premise or do you start off with the character?
You know, I usually, yeah, it is a great question. It depends. For the Allison series, I thought I started with a character. And for the Greenhouse series, I started with a premise. Sometimes I start with a title that feeds, and I don't know if you hear my dog, but I have a
yes,
small
but that's
view
okay. That's okay. You're a pet person that makes you that endears you even more. So, you know, I'm surprised. I have five cats. I'm surprised they're not screaming. But no, they're all napping right now. So, you must have a lot of ideas for story, I would imagine. And are you one of those people who jots down little notes on papers, and then you clean your purse out at the end of the week? You go, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh yeah, I got
to
keep my right. Whether it's a character, I do. So I know that a lot of writers do that. I mean, I even have a friend who has one of those, like, I don't remember what they're called, but a voice-activated recorder, you know? And whenever she sees something, she makes a note to herself, you know, like an MP3 recorder, and then plays it back and, you know, writes it down and everything. She has like a journal that she writes all kinds of little weird phrases in and all that. So how, when you want to write a story, how do you know which character or which conversation or which scenario you want to start with? How do you decide?
You know, normally I'm starting with an image.
Because you're the visual
honestly,
person. Yeah.
Right.
I am visual. In the very opening of Bitter Harvest, it starts with her thinking of a chair on the top of a hill. And the chair, it's an Adirondack chair. She went hiking, and the chair is sitting, no spoilers here, but the chair is sitting on the position on the hill in such a way that it has a perfect view of her.
What do you
house.
Mean no swear words here? You're on my show.
No spoilers.
oh, okay. I thought she said no.
I told Ed Ainge he's listening.
I know, yeah, because usually Ed, you know, is PMing questions to me because he can't call it. By the way, hold on just one second, everyone. I want to give the call-in number. So if you want to talk to Wendy Tyson and Lisa Daly, please call in. The number is 347-633-9609. And I'll tell you what, I'll give away a book each. So we'll give away e-books today, one from Lisa and one from Wendy. So call in. This could be your banner day, okay? 347-633-9609. Okay, so you start with this. More and more from authors, and particular, not just women but men too, are saying, "I have the picture in my head, and then I go and write it down."
Yeah, this was a chair. This was an actual chair in Vermont that I came across. I took a picture, and I do that a lot. I'm very fascinated by abandoned buildings, abandoned structures. And so a lot of times if I see something that speaks to me, I'll take a photograph and I'll use that as I'll anchor it, I'll put it on my computer, and it'll kind of speak to me over time. So that was the image I had. But I'm a huge fan, and if there's aspiring authors out there, of Natalie Goldberg and her books, Writing Down the Bones, I loved it. And I'm a huge fan of just pen to paper free writing. So that's how I start my book.
Yes.
I have the image. What is it? And I just keep asking myself questions and let my head kind of go where it will. And inevitably out of that comes the premise or the concept in a form that I can work
with. I love that. You know, you're engaging all your senses. Do you read out loud any of your storyline?
Oh, always. That's, if I can read the whole thing
so
out loud,
important.
I do. And I think so, absolutely. And I have an audience, a built-in audience of a pair of 13-year-old boys who I pay. No, I'm kidding. But they, like, you know, sometimes I'll just have a chapter or something, and I need to hear it out loud, and I want to,
yes.
listen to it for me.
Yeah, there is something. Yeah, there is something
go ahead,
to
Lisa.
That. There's a rhythm to writing that sometimes you don't get. If you're just reading it, you don't get it in the same way that you do when you're reading out loud. It's like when you're teaching your kids to read and you're reading to them Dr. Seuss or Sandra Boynton, there's
yes.
a musicality to that type of writing that you don't find in other books. And I think there's
yes.
something. I think there's really something to that, that you really don't get that extra element until you read it out loud, and it sort of brings the story to life. And I'm fascinated by the idea that you are so interested in abandoned buildings, because when you're in an abandoned chair or a shack or something, because what struck me when you were talking about that was that if they're abandoned, then there's plenty of room for your story in there.
Yep,
and there's a backstory too. There's a backstory
right.
too. So
I have
an abandoned structure
in every book that I have written.
It's amazing.
An abandoned.
I want
a structure
in every book.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about speaking out loud what you've written, because again, if you're a female writing from a male POV, not that I think they're so complicated. I'm sorry, guys, you just aren't, you know. But
they're lovely
it, you know?
Human beings. I think most guys would say that they're not particularly complicated. I think they think women are complicated,
really,
and sometimes we are. But guys really
we're just
they
smarter.
Are
just I mean, that's all. They're not, and we're just smarter, and that's all there is to it. And I'm sorry, I love them, but it's the extra Y chromosome. You can't help yourself. But it's just like when men write from a woman's point of view. I don't want the characters, when I'm reading them, to sound the same. They should not
yeah.
have the same tone, inflection. They should not say the same words. There are some books that I read. Now, you know, you were talking about reviewers and NetGalley and everything else. I'm one of their power reviewers. I mean, I read everything from them. And so I'm really critical about dialogue. That, to me, is so important, because dialogue is either going to make or break a story. I'm sorry, that's just how I feel about it. If you have a female who's telling the story and then you're writing the male voice, and it sounds like the female voice, or the word choice is wrong for a man. Like, I've never heard a guy hear this kind of, you know, say this kind of thing. So, you know,
right?
It's not right. It's not right. It's not an expression I've ever heard a man use. Yeah, to me, it pulls me right out of the story. And I know that I read a lot more than most people do, but still, I would think that, you know, most sentient beings who read, I mean, you're fairly intelligent if you read, but, you know, the world doesn't read. And so I think that's, you're at a higher plane than a lot of people if you read books. But I
think there's something
dialogue
to that.
Yeah, I really think that, you know, if your dialogue, when you read it out loud and it sounds the same coming from the man and the woman, you're going to hear it. And David Morrell tells me that all the time, and Jeffrey Deaver tells me that all the time, because I love having them on the show, and John Lasqua the same way, because they always say the same thing. You have to read your dialogue. Otherwise, how do you know if it doesn't sound right?
Right.
How do you know?
I think there's some real truth to that.
Yeah, and here's the other interesting thing, just from a reader's standpoint, I will tell you, because lately I've been talking a lot about Audible books, which I've never listened to. I've never listened to a book on tape. I've never listened to Audible or anything like that. I can't be in a quiet space and have someone reading to me. I'll go to sleep or my mind will wander. But it's serious. I want to hold my Kindle or read a book. But to me, that's the way to do it. But how do you know what your book is going to sound like if you haven't read parts of it out loud? I mean, how do you know?
I don't know. I couldn't agree with you more. I think that reading it out loud, I think you said it earlier, Lisa, you can hear the rhythm, you can hear the dialogue.
Yeah.
And that very first writer's group that I went to, I attended some classes by a woman named Toni LoPopolo, and she at the beginning of every class, everybody handed in 10 pages of their work in progress, and she read it aloud to the whole group. And her purpose was exactly that, listen to your words spoken, and you'll see the gaps. You'll hear what's not working. You'll hear the redundancies. You'll hear the, you know,
yes.
the too much in the head. And it was such an eye-opener.
Well, it is interesting, too. I tend to sort of over-punctuate when I'm writing. I use probably more commas than are necessary. And part of the reason that I do that is that I want to use them, you know, like speed bumps. I want to control the way that, because I'm trying, you know, because I'm writing humor. Right. I want to control that they get to that, you know, to that point, or they get to the joke, or they get that pause before, you know, before that last bit of the line in the way that I want them to read it. And punctuation is, you know, is obviously one way to do that. But certainly dialogue is another. Those pauses, even where you put, you know, said in the sentence, can change the meaning of it and the feel of it. And it can be the exact same line, but depending on how you, you know, how you put that sentence together, it can change. And if you don't read it out loud and hear that pause as you're reading it, or the lack of a pause, then you're not going to know that. I do find it really interesting that I'm wondering if you found this to be true as well, but it seems like when I see books from first-time novelists, they often try to do a multiple POV. You know, they have like three different points of view, which is really challenging. Even for experienced authors, it's very challenging for them to do multiple points of view, just for the reasons Pam was talking about earlier, that it's really hard to get, especially if you're, you know, you're not particularly experienced, it's really difficult to get, you know, different dialogue, different, you know, words and expressions and just sort of different ways of being. And was your first book, was it a single point of view? Was it first person? Was it multiple point of view?
No.
Did you see the same thing?
My first published book was multiple points of view and third person. And that's actually my favorite. I'm not a huge fan. I like reading it. I'm not a huge fan of writing in the first person. The Greenhouse series is one single third person throughout. You know, I think the key, and you're right, it's hard to get right for those reasons, because it's a balance. On one hand, you need each character to have their own voice, but on the other hand, if they're so jarringly different, it takes you outside of the writer starts
it does.
Through as opposed to the characters. And so, you know, I think of it as, we're actors, right? I mean, really, a writer is an actor. It's just that instead of acting on stage, we act out on the paper. We put ourselves in the position of the character.
In your world building. Yes, you do.
Yeah.
So your characters have to relate to the world you've created. I will tell you, Lisa, from a reader's standpoint, I freaking hate over-punctuators. If you're punctuating, to blow me down. It just pisses me off. It's like, let me read this. Trust your reader to read at the pace you want them to.
It's not every line. It's just specific ones. But I will keep that. The next time I'm writing, I'll put a little picture of you on my laptop.
There you go.
Pam doesn't want me to use that extra comma.
Here's the thing. I say this whenever I beta read for someone, especially, you know, newbies. I always say, don't tell me what you want me to know. Write the story and let me form my own storyline, my own opinions. Let me hear the characters
Absolutely.
How I want to hear them. You know, don't treat me like you're teaching me to read. So it's really important for, but because sometimes, I mean, these, I almost can imagine like the little dialogue bubble over a character's head. It's like, don't tell me why someone says what they're doing. Trust me to be smart enough as a reader. As a reader,
right.
I'm not a movie goer where I'm seeing a visual and hearing dialogue and music and everything else. I'm reading a book because I enjoy reading. Trust me enough to understand what your intent of your story is. I think intention with everything we do is so important. The same way with writers, you know, what is the intent of this story? What are you trying to share with me? And then if you're telling me a story, let me enjoy the story without you teaching me about it. Don't
right.
be leaning
well, and
over
you really
my shoulder.
Shouldn't see. You shouldn't see the seams in good writing. You shouldn't feel that extra comma. You shouldn't. If you're noticing it,
yeah.
then I've done it wrong, or the writer has
problem.
Done it wrong.
Oh,
yeah,
listen,
yeah, it
I
is.
Mean,
certainly,
said,
yeah.
I have 120,000 words, and would you read it? And I'm saying, 120,000 words, really? On your first book? and half of the book was every time there were four main characters, it was an ensemble piece in fantasy, and every time one of the characters said something, there was an italicized version of why they said what they said. And I said, erase all that crap. Take all of that out
oh,
of
wow.
there.
That's
you don't have
killing
to explain.
Me.
The dialogue itself between the characters tells me what the story is about. You don't have to justify your characters
every single
discussion.
Thing.
Well, yes, their dialogue. Oh my God!
Yeah.
And then you know we got down to 75,000. It was a wonderful book after that, but it almost made me lose my mind. You know,
yeah.
I know
what
Pam,
I
always a young adult series. I'm sorry. Go
well,
ahead.
And I think
go
it's
back.
A difference between a. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I always go back to Hemingway's short story, Hills Like, I think it's Hills Like White Elephants, which
mm-hmm.
is a very short story, but it, to me, it so eloquently shows that, you know, there's no explanation. You pick everything up from the story. And when I,
right.
every once in a while, I'll go back and reread it as a reminder of craft and the ways to do that, either through dialogue, what you're not saying, right? What you're not doing.
Exactly.
As well as what you are doing with your characters.
Well, Wendy, I think you started off saying that you always were writing, and so you wrote poems. And this is, you're talking about Hemingway and short stories. Haiku is five short lines, and it tells
yeah.
an entire story. Lisa, Joe Clifford is amazing. Writes amazing flash fiction. So 700 to 1,000 words tells an entire story to me. It's a scene, but it's a story. So
right.
kind of less is – everybody says less is more. You know, Elmore Leonard always said that. That was his thing, less is more. And, you know, Jeff Deaver tells me it's an economy of words. You use an economy – even if your book is 700 pages – you don't want them to be 700 pages of nonsense. It should be story, and it should
right.
always be moving forward. So, yeah, I think reading
and
is
it's
important.
Hard.
And
it's hard to
yes,
do the simpler
sure
stuff. If you think about,
absolutely.
I was thinking about wedding dresses and how a Vera Wang gown is this simple, beautiful, clean
so
line
yes.
versus, you know, the $199 special that's covered in lace and
ruffles
sequins.
And
all.
Yeah.
Right, and the construction is so much more challenging and complex for the gown that at first glance looks to be this simple thing. It's a much more challenging thing to put together than the gown with all the frosting on it, because it
absolutely.
Has to be... it has to be clean and cut well, and it has to be perfect in its
absolutely.
Own sort of way, because you don't. There's no space for flaws. And I Joe is such a great example. This is a guy who's, you know, he writes this sort of darker, noirish,
yes.
these thrillers, and his writing is so good and so
very clean.
It's very clean. He is. And he's one of those guys, if you've not read him, you should. He's going to break out. I think with his next book, it's just phenomenal. But his stuff is so good and so well thought out. And certainly there are authors that sell a ton more copies than Joe Clifford does. But it's not. But those are the marshmallow dresses with the sequins and the lace and the, you know, and the fluff on them. So he's a great author.
Wendy, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought we lost you for a second. You just kind of fell asleep, you know, because we were too busy talking over you. What is the best piece of writing advice you ever got?
Oh, boy. You know, I think probably the best piece of advice I got, I mean, you know, you hear all the, you know, don't give up and keep going and
right. Yeah, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about writing advice because that's career advice, and then there's writing advice.
Yeah, I would say the psychology aspect. Someone said to me at one point that will get you farther as an author than many other things, because so much of writing is about human psychology, relationships. People want to know not just the what, but the why. And so using that and observe, to your earlier point, make notes, you know, be a student of human nature. And I think that was probably the best piece of advice that I've gotten, because I think craft you can learn. It takes a lot.
Yes.
You know, it takes time like anything else. But to be that student of human nature and to watch people and to be open to experiences, to be open to different points of view, I think that's a gift or something that you really, you know, if you don't have it naturally, have to cultivate.
Absolutely. Who is your first reader, Wendy?
My first reader is usually my publicist. She's also a very good editor, and the book concierge, I'll give her a little shout out. So she's my first reader. I have a couple of friends who are really good readers who will read as well for me. And then it usually goes at that point, sometimes my agent, and then it usually goes off to the editor. If I'm doing something that's not a book that's on deadline, then I might send it to a writer friend or two to get feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Before sending it off to my publicist or my agent, like a short story or something.
Oh, cool. We're way over our time allotment, but I don't care, you know. I changed it so we can talk as long as we want. But I do want to do some. I want to have both of you come back because I love this conversation. There's so much more we can talk about. But I want to do final five quick questions, five quick answers. I want both of you to play, and I'm going to ask you different questions, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So I'm going to start off with you, Wendy, because you're the featured guest tonight. How important are blurbs on books?
So I think in the beginning they're more important than as you go forward. I personally, when I'm a reader, I don't necessarily pay that, to be frank, I don't pay that much attention to blurbs. But I do think when you're starting out as a writer, I think it's helpful to have them. It gives you some confidence. It gives you something to connect with outside of, you know, your little world when you're promoting your books. And, of course, you know, it's always nice from a networking standpoint to have that. I don't know, Lisa, if you agree with me.
I think it's interesting. The media really seems to pay, just from my publicist perspective, the media really pays attention to whether or not you've been blurbed by someone who's a USA Today bestseller or a New York Times bestseller. But I think what readers don't really know is by the time you're on your second or third book, you're asking people, other authors you already know. It's not like, you know, the, when you're a first-time author where the you know, this other author has to take a risk to blurb you. It's generally people you know
right.
who already know and like your work. So, yeah.
So would you both be surprised to learn that readers don't give a damn about, they care less about blurbs? It's an interesting
no.
thing that it really is true. And I'll tell you why. It's not for any reason that you think. I mean, unless you're James Patterson, and, you know, I have mixed feelings about that, but I will tell you that most readers say they don't even know who the hell the other authors are on the book, and so it means absolutely nothing to them. So I just
yeah.
want to share that with you. I think that you're right in as far as if it's your first book, it's nice to have a name out there for readers and all. So just chew on that for a little while because I thought that was really funny. So, Wendy, how important in your world is social media to you as a writer, okay?
Yeah, I think it's very important, and it takes a lot of time. I'm primarily active on Facebook and on Twitter. I would say my readership, especially in the cozy world, I've met a lot of readers through Facebook, and they tend to be very loyal, just a great support
yes.
network, really really great readers. And so I would say from that perspective, it's important. Of course, you always have to balance it with the fact that you need to be writing.
Right.
You know, and that's the balance we strike as an author. But I think
yeah.
it, I think
well, and here, and so I have a tip for you about that, because you're right.
Yeah.
What happens is you're going to, you have your computer on and or your laptop, whatever you're working on. And other than the fact that you're handwriting, you handwrite, but when you're, you know, you've got a work in process there and you're on the internet, turn your internet off, like disengage from it, and that way you won't be tempted to go back because it takes a while sometimes to connect. So I try, what does authors say, how do you
do
so much?
That's a great idea.
Because I'm a social media crazy woman, you know. I mean, we have 450,000 social media followers, you know, and
wow.
3 million listeners in 45 countries. You know, we've worked really hard to get there, and you know, which is why I get up at 5:30 in the morning. And you know, if I don't walk out of the house with my dress on backwards, I consider it a good day. But
me too, but for different reasons.
Yeah, right. So we won't talk about your alcohol problem, Lisa. Okay.
She's got that red wine.
Teasing. 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 It's a joke, everyone. Lisa and I know each other. Really, it's a joke. Okay, so that's the thing. If you can't figure out why you can't write and you keep getting pulled in, because it's a time suck. You know, Facebook, Twitter, they're a time suck. Disconnect from the internet. It's a pain in the ass to get back connected again. So trust me on that. If you need to get work done, disconnect from the internet and just use your word processing. My next question, and it goes to Lisa, and that is, if you could not write, okay, there's no more writing, we're in an alternative universe, don't have a heart attack either of you, you're in in an alternate universe, what would you choose to do as your occupation?
Oh my gosh, that's
what have you
so
always
hard.
Wanted to try? What have you always wanted to try? Like, this is, you know, it's so far out there, but I really think it's cool and I want to try this. What would you do?
You know, the funny thing is I always try to do the things that I want to try. And the thing that
okay,
I would want to do.
We're in an alternate universe.
In an alternate universe, I want to be a circus performer. Because
there you go.
I know, it's the weirdest
that.
Thing. It's the weirdest thing ever. But so Sarasota, where I live, is a circus town.
Of course it is.
Ringling Brothers. Exactly.
Right.
And we have this really cool thing here called Sailor Circus, which is the longest running children's circus in the world. They've been
ever
around
right.
for
wow.
yeah, it's been like almost 70 years. And my daughter actually participates, and I remember the first time that I ever went into that arena, and I actually went because a neighbor of mine, her daughter was performing, and I'm thinking I'm going to like a dance recital. I have no idea that it's like this massive arena with thousands of people and that you have little tiny kids juggling fire and walking on the high wire and all that. And I just remember having this feeling like, remembering when I was a kid, the first time I ever saw the circus, and thinking that I
right.
would love to walk the high wire or do a, you know, be in the trapeze act, and that all these kids get to do this. And the funny thing is that several years later, I was involved with a fundraiser, and they asked me, and we actually did it at Circus, and they asked me if I would be willing to try and act. And I said, oh, my gosh, can I be a trapeze artist? And they said, well, that's going to be over the buffet table, so no, but you can do something else. And so I learned to walk the – yes, I learned how to walk the high wire. I practiced for, like, 3 months with this lovely couple called the Merritts, who had been these big high wire walkers, like, in the 70s and 80s. And it was absolutely fantastic. It was one of the most exciting things I've ever done.
Okay,
and so
I want pictures. I want pictures that didn't happen, and I want them on my timeline, girlfriend. That's all there's to it. I love that. Wendy, what about you? It's an alternate universe. I want it as crazy as it comes, although I don't know if you can beat Lisa for that.
I don't think I can.
Is this,
I know
is
exactly
something you always wanted
to
do? Tell me.
Yes, I always wanted to work with dolphins. I wanted to
see
a dolphin.
Oh, that's really.
See,
you need to be in Florida
with
us, because you could do that down here. We've got lots of places where you can swim with dolphins and you know, have that sensory experience, and where you work with kids and dolphins and all kinds of stuff, all down in Florida. You're missing out by not being down here with us.
See, I am.
We'll find you a place.
Some of them have background. I'd like to do that or work with baby pandas in China, but one or the other in that alternate universe. Yeah, I like
we
animals.
Want you in China. We want you to stay there. We want you to come to Southwest Florida and stay with us.
That's right.
So
that's right. We're going to hook
you
up with those dolphins.
So, Wendy, every writer has a toolbox, whether it's an imaginary one, whether there's something tangible in your toolbox. What is one of the tools that you need, you pull out of your toolbox every time you start to write?
Toolbox.
Yeah, is it coffee? Is it a candle? Is it music? Do you have to sit a certain place in a certain chair? Is it a mood? Is it a time of day? What is it that sets you
up
for the writing?
The honest truth, which is my life is so crazy. I have 3 dogs, 3 children, a full-time job that's 30 miles away from my house, a husband. I can honestly write anywhere. I wrote a whole book while we were on this phone call. No, I'm kidding. But I can write anywhere and anytime. I have no choice but to do that. So I don't have a
I'm always impressed by writers who can do that. I know other authors
who can
on
do
Twitter.
That.
Yeah, they'll be like, oh, I wrote my whole book on my phone at the park. Like, they every day they're at the park, their kid's on the swings, and she's getting down her 2,000 words
and
a day.
And on the phone.
Like, on her phone, which is genius.
Phone,
yeah. I can't
oh
do that.
God.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Okay. That's so your toolbox is really open space, anytime, any place. You write without bars and walls, and that's great. What about you, Lisa?
I will always start a book at the beach, and it's amazing to me, because I used to do that as sort of a treat for myself. I mean, I live 8 minutes away from Siesta Key Beach, which is incredible. And I used to do that as sort of a treat if something was going well, if I was ahead of my deadline. And then a friend of mine wrote a book called, I think it was 2,000 to 10,000, and she basically had given all of these different talks at writers' conferences where basically you could boost your word count every day. And I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to write 10,000 words, and I don't. But one of the tools that she had suggested, one of the ideas that she had, was to just track your writing to see where do you write more. Do you write more in your office, at a coffee shop, at the beach? And it turns out that I write twice as fast at the beach as I do at my office.
Wow.
So I just have my little iPad and keyboard and my beach chair in the back, and every single day that I can get out to the beach, that's where I write. And there's no internet, and I just have the sound of the ocean, and it's just the greatest thing in the whole world.
Lisa, isn't it?
That's
I was going to say that separation from the everyday is great, I'm sure. Yeah.
It definitely.
I want to just finish this up. First of all, I have one more question that I'm going to ask each of you, but I want you first, Lisa Daly, tell everyone where to find your books and where to find you in the web.
Thank you. My books are available at bookstores everywhere. You can find me at lisadaily.com, D-A-I-L-Y, and I'm on Twitter at Lisa Daily. So, yeah, I love to connect that way. So thank you.
Wonderful. And the fabulous Wendy Tyson, our very Hello. Special guest tonight. Tell everybody where to find you, please.
Sure. I'm at watyson.com, watyson.com. And Twitter is at Wendy Tyson, and Facebook is Wendy Tyson Author. But all those links are on my website. So if they go there, they'll find them.
Okay.
So thank you for asking.
So, of course, who do you want to give shout-outs to, Wendy?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout-out to my husband and my children, who have just been an amazing support throughout this whole journey, and my agent, Fran Black, who is just the biggest cheerleader, and Henry Press, and Ro Karanen, who is my publicist. So I think those are my shout-out. And one final shout-out for International Thriller Writers. I'm a huge fan, member.
Yes.
They've been very good to me. I write for The Big Thrill and The Thrill Begins.
I know you do.
And Ed, and Amar and the group for Murderers Row. I can't say enough. They've been like family.
They're great.
So
Aww.
Just feel so grateful. So
they're
you.
Great. Liz, who do you want to give a shout-out to?
Well, to you and Wendy, for sure, because this has just been so much fun tonight. I just had a blast. And, of course, everybody at Ocean View, because that's how we met. So, yeah, so thank
Absolutely.
You so much for having me on. I've really been thrilled. It's been great. Wendy is fantastic.
All right, so I'm so glad that you came on with me. It's been such an interesting evening. Here's my final – I'm going to give you your choice of questions. Well, no, actually, I'm not. So – I think I have so many more I could ask in Final Five because I just keep thinking them up. So one night I did a show where I asked all the authors I knew to call in, and I said, in exchange for you calling in, answering one question, you can tell everybody about yourself, your books, where you are on the Internet, and you know, everybody gets their chance to talk. So 75 authors call in. And the one question was, if you won the lottery, would you continue to write? So there were a couple souls who said, hell no, I'm not writing anymore. And, you know, others who said, of course I'm going to write. So then my next question is, it's not if you won the lottery, are you going to continue to write? Because you two are so young in your careers and you have so much more to write about. But here's the big question. Are you going to charge for your books after you win the lottery? So, Lisa, let's start with you.
I don't think it's so funny because I talked to my kids about estate planning, basically, like what happens to
right.
all of these works after I'm gone, and you know, we make jokes
right.
about the Lisa Daly Museum and all that stuff.
Right.
But one of the things
right.
that my son has been really adamant about, which I think is fantastic, is that schools should always get your books for free. He's like, and I think that is a really fantastic idea. If I win the lottery, then sure, absolutely. Everybody reads Lisa Daly for free.
There you go.
It has to be
okay.
a really big lottery. If I just win like the $25 scratch off, not happening.
No. We're talking retire, buy your friends each
house.
But the
big lottery. Yeah.
Right.
I still write
yeah.
every day, and yeah.
There you go. So, okay, Wendy. So I want you to wait a minute. You think I'm going to give you the same question, but oh my goodness, how long you are!
I did. I didn't answer that.
You are already with your answer. I know, Miss Smarty Pants. So your three kids and your husband, and we're throwing in the three pets, and I are going to write a book about your life,
oh.
and it's going to be a really fun book. But we don't have a title, so what are we going to call it?
Oh my goodness, the big mess, chaos. I think you could choose anything in that vein.
No, you have to choose. Tell me the title of your book.
The Long and Winding Journey. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. I think maybe something like The Long and Winding Journey. I don't have a good snappy answer for that one.
That's okay. It's whatever comes to mind. There's no snap involved. I cannot thank you both enough for joining me. What a fun conversation about every different thing under the sun. We have to do this again. Promise we'll have a reunion in like 6 months. You know, Lisa, when your book comes out, you're going to be the guest, and Wendy's going to co-host with me, and we're going to have a good time, okay?
That sounds awesome. Would
that be
Pam,
a plan?
This was fabulous. I feel like I could talk to the two of you all evening, so thank you.
I do, too. I feel like we know each other so well, and so I can't thank you enough for being on, both of you, with me on Authors on the Air tonight. And remember, go and get Lisa's books and go and get Wendy's book is on sale for 99 cents. You can't beat that with a stick, I'm telling you. Thank you so much, ladies. Happy International Women's Day. You are two terrific, wonderful women. I'm very honored and very proud to call friend. Thank you so much for being with me tonight.
Aww. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Pam. Thanks,
You're
Lisa.
Absolutely welcome. Okay, we'll talk again soon. Have a good night, ladies. Good
you
night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that's our show tonight, friends. On Friday, I'll be talking to another wonderful woman, Carolyn Haynes. I hope you join me. Thank you for joining us tonight. Thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.